Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of a Shabbat sermon by Rabbi Adam Kligfeld.
My name is Adam. My name is Adam and I went to Columbia. Class of 95. That sentence was once a source of weird American Jewish, probably overly elitist pride. Now it's almost a little embarrassing. My years at Columbia were an era both of investment in self and expression of my identity and curious exploration of others' narratives and identities as well. I felt intellectually alive and emotionally embraced my entire time there. Jewish life there was extraordinary, as was Zionist life. But not without some exceptions. I remember one particularly hard circumstance. Some rabidly anti-Zionist speaker was coming to campus for a big lecture. And the Jewish Zionist student community was nervous and activated. How should we handle it? Do we picket the speech with chants? Do we all sign up and arrive early so that most of the seats were filled by us? Do we ask the administration to step in, because what other hate speech on that level would or should be celebrated at Columbia or any other campus? What most of us decided to do was none of those options. We filled the lawn outside Fernald Hall, right in front of the building in which the speech would take place. We didn't chant. We didn't jeer. We stood in silent vigil as those were gathering for the speech and went in to hear it and came out of it, holding our Israeli flags and holding our silence. In the moment, it felt measured and appropriate and even holy. And I remember an excoriating public letter by then graduate student Zev Magen, who is now a professor of Arabic and Islamic history and chair of the Middle East Studies Department at Bar-Ilan University. He took us to task for under-responding to what he perceived then as a still small but threatening affront to Jewish and Zionist well-being on campus. He lambasted us for being silent, like sheep, evincing what he considered to be a meekness. He thought we were overly noble. And I remember shaking when reading his letter. Was he right? Was this the beginning of a civilizational war? And what would such a fight require of us? The feeling on campus was tense, and it was intense, between Jews, Zionists, and those opposed to Israel's very existence, and also among Jews who disagreed about how to confront this type of event and what it represented. It was really hard. And how I wish we could go back to that time and cherish it for its quaintness, for its being an exception that seemed to prove the rule that, in general, Israel as a nation state of and for the Jews was an accepted reality. That Jews and Zionists could walk and be and live on campus unimpeded. That anti-Zionist speakers were both terrifying and rare. And that anti-Zionist activism was present but contained and not overly menacing. Those were the good old days. These are worrying days. Jewish leaders on and off campus who are generally not prone to Chicken Little histrionics are asking unfathomable, only partly rhetorical questions. Yehuda Kurtzer, who's one of the wisest and most grounded of contemporary Jewish thinkers, asked on Facebook yesterday, "Real question, friends, as Jews in America, how scared do you think we should be?" And 4 hours later, there were 150 responses, ranging from the not at all to pack your bags. And most of the recent angst and fear comes not from Israel, Gaza itself, although, of course, there's still an enormous amount going on there, but from Columbia and UCLA. And name your campus. The protests, encampments, threats, and full upheaval have claimed every headline, roiled nearly every college, split a divided America even further apart, split liberal Jews from purported allies, and has torn apart Jewish communities and families who find themselves far apart from one another on some of these essential issues. These are hard times. And I want to address those campus protests, filtered through and suffused with words of Torah. But first, I want to share some caveats. I want to set the boundaries of ideas and stances within which I want you to hear what I have to say. I am, and I imagine I always will be, an ardent Zionist who believes the Jewish return to Jewish land and establishing Jewish sovereignty is one of the greatest of all human stories. And I thrill to live in this era. Number two, the Jews who returned to Zion in the late 1900s and early 1800s, early 1900s, did not, as some far-right thinkers and propagandists would like you to believe, return to an empty, desolate land. There were people there who traced their lineage in that land back centuries. They and their descendants deserve to live with dignity, in peace, with a chance at a meaningful and liberated life of meaning and purpose and love. There are many ways that may be achieved, and which one of them I think is the right one changes just about every day. Number three, Hamas is a jihadist death cult that thrills at the loss of Palestinian life even more than a taking of Jewish life, because the former helps their warped, perverted cause even more. There will be no peace with or for Palestinian Arabs until Hamas and its clones are gone, defeated as soundly as was Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Their perpetuation is a threat and looming tragedy for Israeli Jews. It's a far larger threat for Palestinian Arabs. Number four, Jewish law and ethics require that power that is wielded in the name of Jewish rights and Jewish people be done with compassion and care, maximizing the efforts to reduce innocent casualties and with an acknowledgement of tragedy for every innocent life taken at any age. Number five, Israel did not ask for this war. Israel respected the cold ceasefire that was in place through October 6th. And a full ceasefire now would be a reward for Hamas. It would be a perpetuation of evil and almost certainly would lead to significantly more innocent deaths of Palestinians in future wars compared to those who would die and suffer in a near complete taking down of Hamas in this war. Number six, I remain grateful for the time I spent in the Palestinian territories on the Encounter program in 2018, amongst other times I've been there, listening to their narratives, hopes, and aspirations. And I truly hope and pray that all those I met, most of whom could simultaneously and accurately be described as moderate on the one hand, and utterly closed to the idea of there being a state of Israel at all on any portion of that land on the other hand, I hope and pray that they and their brothers and sisters will shake off the evil leadership that subjugate them, misrepresent them, indoctrinate them, and block them from the life of goodness that they and their descendants deserve. And with that in mind, I'd like to start my sermon. When you're not sure what to say or how to say it, Torah can help. It can give a frame and even a whisper and a charge from across the centuries. Acharei Mot, as Sadie has already taught us, starts with laws about the ritual of Yom Kippur. Two goats are involved. Spoiler alert, one of them doesn't make it. The one that does stands in front of the Kohen Gadol to receive the sins of the people and carry them away to the wilderness. And when the Torah describes this ritual moment, Midrash and commentators notice a redundancy. V'hit vada alav et kol avonot bnei Yisrael. The Kohen confesses all of the iniquities of the Israelites. V'et kol pishehem, all of their transgressions. L'chol chatotam, and all of their sins. Okay, we get it. The Torah knows some synonyms for bad things that Jews do. It's like Eskimo's abundance for words for snow. But why this redundancy here? And are there shades of meaning that distinguish between these words? Rabbi Harold Kushner of blessed memory paraphrases a midrash from the Talmud and spins it into something truly wonderful. And to me, incredibly relevant to the orgiastic, menacing, and I think crazed behavior we have witnessed on campuses. He says avonot from the word avon means something twisted, upended, opposite of what it should be. That's one category of wrong behavior for which the Kohen was asking forgiveness. Pishehem is from the word pesha, which means rebellion, rejecting the law. Knowing the law or the rule is this, and still choosing to do that. And chatotam is from the word chait, which we often translate as sin, but really has to do with a swing and a miss, a lost opportunity. When you discuss baseball in Hebrew, the word for strike is from that root. It's a hachta'a. The ball or the opportunity came, you swung, and you missed. And you made things worse for yourself and for others. And together, pesha, avon, and chait, a twisting, a rejection of the law and norms, and missing the mark, helped me understand my own reaction to the last 2 weeks. First, avon, twisting. How maniacally effective some of these warriors, we're now learning funded for decades by Qatar, have been in inverting the meaning of words and ethics over the last decades. Overwhelming much of American academia, convincing much of the media that true committed evildoers are heroes and flawed democracies are evil. That those defending themselves against explicit intent to commit genocide are rather justifiably accused of committing genocide. One of the signs on campus this week said, students will leave when Israelis leave. As the writer Nellie Bowles put it, it's weird. These pro-peace protesters seem to be really pro-war. The same people who justifiably would be outraged if a single group of campus protesters blocked off an area and access to one who was gay or black or Asian or female or Muslim or Arab. They truly pride themselves and are lauded by others as they gleefully film themselves blocking a pathway on a public or private university to anyone Jewish or anyone who certainly does not in that moment proactively denounce Israel and Zionism. The Talmud named three sins for which, in certain circumstances, one was enjoined to give one's life rather than commit. One of them was to bow down to an idol in the presence of a Gentile demanding you do so. Jews would rather die than yield to forced paganism. Those laws emerged from centuries of Greek and Roman persecution. And this week, Jews were literally faced with a choice of publicly repudiating the state of Israel or being disallowed from walking past by people who had no authority to disallow it. More on that later. This is avon, pure and simple, twisted behavior of masses of addled minds. Eugene Kantorovich, the Israeli legal scholar who teaches at George Mason, and full disclosure, holds some views that I consider to be extreme and misguided, put all of this avon twistedness into some biting sarcasm in a tweet. He wrote, "I can't wait until on-campus orientation starts next semester. And the administrators give their usual warnings about microaggressions, making sure everyone feels safe and getting all the pronouns right," my editorial note, which they should do. Back to him. "They're going to do it totally straight, like nothing happened. I'd go back to college just to see it." End quote. In the realm of Avon, microaggressions are not to be tolerated, but actual aggressions, like screaming, "We don't want no Zionists here," and campus intifada, and referencing campus Zionists as, quote, Al-Qassam's and Hamas's next targets, are not only tolerated, they are venerated. Some of the Avon twistedness comes in the form of gaslighting and the relentless double standard. After weeks of menacing and threatening encampments and slogans, there's a peaceful pro-Israel rally organized at UCLA this past Sunday, filled with prayers for the hostages and for peace. And somehow that is painted as aggressively and unnecessarily confrontational. When I arrived at that rally on Sunday, I passed a phalanx of angry, fuming anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic zealotry just to get to the area of the Israel rally, which itself was wedged in between the impromptu phalanx and the blocked-off, impenetrable area of the encampment. And to get to the other side of the stage, just in order to hear and see the speakers, you could move around to the left or to the right. The left side was closer, so Lev, my son, and I made our way. Once we got flush to the stage, we met a wall of, I'm not sure what to call them, maybe counter-counter-protesters? Counter-counter-counter-counter-protesters? Locked arm in arm, staring hatefully and threateningly as we approached. And like the scene in Holy Grail, except not funny at all, and nobody lost an arm, they made it clear, none shall pass. They were blocking our access to our rally. They screamed at me when I tried to gently go in between them. They would not budge. Security did not help. In order to burst through there, I would have had to become the aggressor, thus fulfilling their Avon-like twisted prophecy. See? We went around the other way, my heart beating very fast. This is a moment to say a few words about the Jewish group that did show up last week and indeed brought violence and mayhem to the encampments. I don't know who they were, though at least one of them is apparently on Team Mashiach from his flag. But they should be repudiated. They and their tactics, they should not have taken that into their own hands, even though the university had been derelict up to that point in dealing with it themselves. They should not have resorted to any physical violence, however goaded they were for those weeks. They should not have stooped to that level, both because it's unconscionable and because it hurts our cause. Because part of this avon is that our margin for error is so slim. As Yossi Klein Halevi said on a recent podcast with Dan Senor, I know and I accept that Israel and Zionists have to be good and then have to be better. But how perfect do we have to be? And can we be in this war? I would add, both on the battlefield and the campus. One wrong move, and this violence was a very wrong move. And any infinitesimal give that might have been extended by administrators or the media or diplomats disappears. To wit, I counted just yesterday 18 individual columns that the LA Times devoted in the A section just to this one part of the story. That's not including the columns about the war and about the arrests, just on that one moment when some Jewish counter-protesters acted with violence to break down the encampments. And that was just in the news section, four more columns of editorial from an editorial board that has been ruefully quiet and calling out the avonot, the twistedness of the previous 2 weeks. When it's the pro-Israel side, it's a mob. When it's the anti-Israel side, it is students being passionate and exercising free speech. And what do you expect after all? They should not have done it, and it was disgraceful. And it's important to say that that one act of overreach on one campus pales in comparison to the viciousness that true enemies of Israel have displayed on dozens of campuses. The group that perpetuated that are our fringe, whom we denounce. Whereas those who take over campuses and hold Houthi flags that say curse the Jews and disrupt entire neighborhoods and vandalize historic university buildings are heralded heroes whom they defend and celebrate. This is Avon. We move to Pesha. This section will be shorter because, at least to me, it's self-evident. As Rabbi Kushner notes, Pesha is rebellion, a rejection of the law by those who are very well aware of the law. The Israel-hating campers of the campus encampments complain, and the LA Times has already editorialized that they were arrested because of their politics. They were not. They were arrested because of their behavior. Not for breaking with a status quo of ideas, but for breaking the law and abrogating campus policies after multiple warnings. We would expect no less, and in fact, we'd see much more if a different group took over and occupied the campus for that long after repeated warnings. Those arrested were arrested for their psha'im, not for their rebellion in this country against that country, Israel, but for their rebellion against the norms that allow any country and any society and any college, university to exist. They drape themselves in law when it serves to protect them, even misappropriating in private settings the American legal principle guaranteeing free speech in public settings. And then they spit on the law and expect no repercussions when the law serves to limit them and their unfettered zealotry. Yehuda Kurtzer, whom I mentioned before, wrote this. He said, number one, the legacy and the central premise of civil disobedience is its awareness of being disobedient with a willingness to accept the consequences. Why do today's student protesters howl at the disciplinary and sometimes law enforcement consequences that result appropriately from their actions? Why aren't these consequences embraced as part of the logic of the protests? And number two, civil disobedience also understands itself to be civil. What credibility do these protests imagine themselves having when they commit vandalism and engage in violent rhetoric? Isn't this now something else entirely? To both of his points and questions, I would say the answer is that we are witness to psha'im, rebellions, by poshim, by those who flout the laws and norms, except the ones that they can wear as a protective shield. The Torah rightly called that out as one of the three primary categories of sinful behavior. And now to chet, a swing and a miss. Abba Iban's famous quote from 1973 has a long half-life and applicability. His words about what was then already decades-long intransigence by Palestinian leaders and an unwillingness to accept that Israel existed was that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. He was being sardonic. In this moment, the aphorism can be applied more plainly. There were so many opportunities over the last months for a different kind of activism on behalf of Palestinians that could have showed more noble colors among the activists, might have drawn more Zionists like me towards them, might even, if the energy spilled to the Middle East, somehow had a chance of changing the reality. Had these protests and encampments begun with a denunciation of Hamas, rather than a tepid rationalization or now a rather lusty defense of them? Dayenu. Had these protests once mentioned the hostages? Dayenu. Had they not mimicked the very conspiracy theorists on the far right that they hate and bought into the truly fake news, suggesting that October 7th was an inside job or that few innocents were killed or targeted or that rape never occurred? Had they been honest and horrified by what began this war? Dayenu. Instead, these protests embodied, and we've also learned, inspired and buttressed the very forces on the planet that unapologetically call for the annihilation of Israel. Such a missed opportunity for these encampments, like far too much of Palestinian society, even beyond Hamas, are too drunk on elimination that they will not lead themselves ever to liberation. No movement that relies and calls for the annihilation of another will lead to the redemption of self. And we have our own crazies in the Zionist camp who need to imbibe that lesson too. And Netanyahu and or his successor should clean the house of these extremists. They're a stain on the Zionism we love. But the center heft of Zionism around the world and in Israel is committed both to the liberation of the Jew and the freedom of all who live in and adjacent to the Jewish state, as long as it does not ipso facto mean the end of the Jewish state. Had the protesters started every night of encampment with a prayer for Gazan civilians and the hostages, with a plea for Palestinian statehood alongside one Jewish state, they would have had me, or at least some of me. And they might have accomplished something. Instead, they swung hard and meanly and in the name of a destruction of me and my people and the state of Israel. And they missed. Chet. It is sinful. And I don't know if they know or care that this approach, this sinful chet-based and hate-based approach to the cause of Palestinian liberation, just reinforces to Jews like me how important it is that Israel remain a strong, viable, and inviolable nation. Every suggestion that the Intifada should be globalized makes me proud that Jewish power can be spread globally. Every time it's made implicitly or explicitly clear that they support that we are the next putative victims, it makes me want to have a stronger Israel and a stronger Israeli army to protect those very victims. Nothing could have more predictably and powerfully turned liberal Zionists into centrist Zionists, or centrist Zionists into right-wing Zionists, than American campus warriors asserting that for there to be life and light and liberation for the Palestinians, there has to be rejection and a defeat and death of Israel itself. Now, we Columbia Lions of the 1990s laughed at the university's official anthem, or the alma mater, which was sung at august occasions. And not just because it was stodgy and just reeked of an all-male campus from the 1900s, but also because, inexplicably, the music it was set to was the same music as, wait for it, the Nazi anthem, a portion of which is still sung as the German national anthem today. The music was written by Joseph Haydn in 1797, and it's been appropriated both by virulent and murderous anti-Semitic regimes and Columbia. Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles in der Welt, stand Columbia, alma mater, through the storms of time abide. It's the same song. You can't make it up, and graduation day was a hoot as a result. But beyond the lampooning of that ridiculous musical Venn diagram, I returned to the lyrics of Columbia's version this week as I read the news about my alma mater, and I wept for it. The second line of lyrics goes like this. Glorified by light supernal, in thy radiance we see light. Doesn't really scan so well. They need to do a better job. Those words are a reference to Columbia's Latin motto, in lumine tuo videbimus lumen, which translates more plainly to, in your light we see light. The original, of course, like at many venerable American universities, is biblical. Hebrew, from Psalms chapter 36, verse 10, Be'orcha nir'e'or, to which I happen to know a catchy tune, which I can tell you afterwards. The full pasuk, the full verse, is Ki imcha makor chayim, for with you, God, is the source of life. Be'orcha nir'e'or, in your light we see light. As Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz interpreted the verse, the notion is that the spiritual life and the desire to be close to the divine and to emulate the divine ought to lead to true benefits and true light in your life and in others' lives. Closeness to God should lead to illumination. You know, whether people were studying theology there or not, or whether their college had this motto or a different one, students who came to American universities for generations, for centuries, were inspired by a secular version of this promise. Come be bathed in light so that you become someone like the gods in whose light others see their own radiance. And then you and they continue to shine on yet others ad infinitum. Knowledge and wisdom and curiosity were to illuminate the mind and the world. They were to be pursued at Columbia and UCLA and wherever great minds came to stimulate and be stimulated, to replace the darkness of the Middle Ages and of ignorance with the blazing white light of learning and growth. Maybe the universities can get back there. Maybe a Columbia can once again be worthy of its motto and its anthem. Maybe if and when the twisted and the rebels and those who swing and miss over and over again can learn to eschew perversion, embrace law and norms, and channel their bodies and their protests and their activism and their passion and their lust, not towards hate and rejection and elimination, but towards the straight and the just and the light.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.